Welcome to Podcast Ed, the podcast of RedefinedOnline.org, covering the stories behind the new definition of public education. On the first of this two-part conversation, Step Up for Students President Doug Tuthill talks with Darrell Bradford, Executive Vice President of 50CAN, a locally led, nationally supported education advocacy organization. The two discuss Bradford's background that led him to become one of the most charismatic and honest advocates in the world of education choice. They also discuss two of his new co-authored policy papers, Fund Everything and Measure Everything, a new mindset on how to approach the world of public education in the wake of the global pandemic, as facts on the ground are rapidly changing and families are searching for options. Thank you for listening and enjoy the episode.
So today I'm excited to have Darrell Bradford, who is the Executive Vice President of 50CAN. I'm excited to have you, Darrell. You're fairly famous in the Ed Choice community for all the right reasons. You are really bright, you're witty, but I think the thing that causes people to have the most respect for you is that you have a lot of integrity and you're always honest. It feels like, you know, you're a guy who really believes in telling the truth and, you know, let it fall where it may. And I think that people respect that. From my perspective, whenever I see your name on something, I always read it because I know that you're gonna give the unvarnished truth and it's gonna be a great read. So I just want to tell you how much I appreciate everything you've done over the years for the movement and what an honor it is to talk to you today.
Doug, I'm choked up. No, that is incredibly kind of you, and I think that other than the fact that I've been super lucky to have, like, you know, this phase of my career be about something that's really important to me sort of personally and professionally and that I feel really strongly about. Much like I think Aristotle talking about the good life, you know, normally you don't know if you lived a good life until you're dead. I hear stuff like this. I feel like I'm doing the right thing while I'm alive. So thank you very much. It's very kind of you.
Well, I'm just trying to be honest. I really think that the voice that you have is really, really important. And I appreciate you having the courage to tell the truth. So thank you.
No, thank you.
So let's talk a little about how you got here. I know a lot of people know about you, but there's a lot of state legislators around the country who listen in and folks that may not be really into the movement. So how did you get into the education choice movement?
So I was living in New York City. So after I graduated from college, I was an English major. You know, I liked to write. That was always my thing. I moved to New York and I was working in the publishing industry. And then I was running this magazine and it folded in August of 2001. And I was laying in my bed and I woke up one morning and that morning was 9/11. And the world changed, you know, on that day. And I spent, you know, the economy was kind of contracting at the same time. The publishing industry was sort of getting flipped on its head. And so I spent a long time trying to figure out what I was going to do next. And in this, like, the early winter of the next year, a friend of mine from college was just like, well, you know, my dad, he started this nonprofit. Maybe you could help him. And I was like, I'll do whatever they want me to do, you know. And so in April of 2002, I got on a plane and I went to Milwaukee. And I had never sort of looked at or thought about, you know, anybody's education, you know, other than my own. And a lot of things sort of became really clear to me, you know, at that time, like looking at charter schools and private school choice and, you know, district response, whatever, and all this other stuff. And, you know, when you're a kid, like, you hear lots of different conversations and they just, you know, from adults, and you, it's like blah, 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 blah. And I remember this one conversation that my mother and my grandmother had at the kitchen table in Southwest Baltimore, where I'm from, where they were talking about whose address I was going to use so I could go to the middle school I was not zoned for, which was called Mount Royal in the Bolton Hill section of Baltimore. And I lived in a neighborhood called Sandtown Winchester. And all of a sudden, like my whole life made sense. Like it had all like snapped into sharp view, realized that, you know, I had an aunt who taught in the Baltimore City public school system. I'd gone to like a regional gifted and talented. I had like choiced into a public middle school in the wealthiest part of the city, which is actually like the worst school I'd gone to, like for me, rather. It was great for other kids, it was bad for me. And then I spent my, you know, the last part of my K-12 career at an independent K-12 Episcopalian boys day school on a scholarship, you know. And I just realized that I had like broken all of these rules, like spoken or unspoken, that are the creatures of public policy and residential assignment and school attendance zones and redlining and all these other things, you know, to get to where I was and then to ultimately kind of have, you know, this job, working on school choice issues in New Jersey at the time. So since then, you know, I've been learning, like I wasn't a political creature, you know, like I didn't know how to run a bill. I didn't know any of this stuff. Like I didn't know how to write, you know, like about public policy. Like I didn't have a big network, but I've been incredibly lucky and very blessed. I've met, you know, tons of great people, you being, you know, among them, obviously, and learned a lot. And, you know, now here I am. I got my cup, I got my, you know, my saber, and I'm just trying to make sure the kids have the same kind of chance I had. So
let's talk a little about 50 Can. To be honest with you, you're an honest guy, and I want to be honest back. Before you joined the organization, I always saw it from afar as progressive but timid, a little cautious. I'm all in, as you know, down at Step Up. We're all in for total parental empowerment. We're really equity driven. You know, we're not one of those guys that say charters are okay, but you know, private choice, oh my God, that's terrible. You know, so, and we're always a little bit condescending, frankly, and a little arrogant towards people who say, you know, I can do charters, but I can't go beyond that because, sure, you know, I'm scared. I acknowledge this is a stereotype, but I just felt like uninformed stereotype that maybe that was 50 Can, but you joined and I was like, wow, you know, I need to rethink this. So tell me what the deal is. I mean, how'd you end up there and what's your organization about? And what's it about now that Darrell Bradford's there?
So it's interesting. You asked a bunch of really good questions on this. So I was working for a, you know, like a state-based nonprofit. I'd moved on from this, the first organization I was working at in New Jersey, which is primarily about school choice stuff, which is what really drives me and which what I'm most passionate about. But, you know, I'd gotten into sort of like elections. So I was like learning about that and primarily working on like teacher evaluation and tenure reform stuff. Also important, you know, but in the end, like and I was at this organization for like 2.5 years. And in the end, like, you know, after we'd passed a piece of tenure reform legislation, I was like, let's go on and like, let's do this other stuff. And, you know, we just weren't quite aligned there. So they were like, you know, Darrell, it's been great. You want to blow up the world? We don't. I was like, I'm fine. You know, like appreciate everything you did for my career. And I was trying to figure out what I was going to do for a while. And I'd known Mark Porter McGee, who was our CEO, for a very long time, because when ConCan, which was like the first can, was being founded, you know, Alex Johnson, who was its founding ED, and other folks there, they came to New Jersey to talk to us about what we were doing. So I knew the ConCan guys, and then I knew Mark, and we sort of like worked, you know, peripherally with one another. I had a great deal of respect for him and for the president, Valet, who I met, who's my other kind of boss, who are really good people. But two things to get specifically, and so that's how I wind up taking on the job at rebooting New York Can. So two things about the structure, I think, though, to get to your point on like choice light or choice all, you know, a lot of these organizations, a lot of Everform organizations grew out of the politics of the Northeast at the time. Yeah. And in the Northeast, it was like, you know, charters were the lucky and dismissive, and I'm a big charter supporter, as you know, right? But they were the lucky and dismissive creature of people saying, well, we can't do vouchers. You know, and so and they rode that for all they could. And so, you know, Connecticut was a state where, you know, maybe private school choice discussion got charters. Like New Jersey was certainly a place where that was absolutely what happened. You know, it was like the charter law was passed specifically because they would not do vouchers. Right. And so those early like proto cans, you know, had that as a limiter. The second thing I would just say is that, like, The organization really is about having local leaders lead. And this might be the important difference lately. So what a state leader is about is what the agenda for that state campaign is going to be about. So like when I took over NICAM, we were about vouchers and charter schools and like really sticking it to the man and like taking those things on. You know, in New Jersey, the sort of founding ED there who was brilliant, you know, was about like inside ball and like charter facilities and that kind of, and lots of things on teachers and equity and those kinds of things, you know, whatever. And certainly when our network expanded, because like we took like three of the campaigns from Students First when it went away, you know, those states, Tennessee, Georgia, and at the time, South Carolina, were much friendlier to this agenda. And so, you know, so we had states that took on vouchers and did those kinds of things. So that's kind of like the evolution of it. The last thing I would just say is that we normally don't try to impose policy on states, you know, which is kind of an important difference. Like some, you know, some organizations that are like ours are like, well, we're just going to set up a chapter and it's going to do what we want, you know? Yeah. And so there's always tension in an organization like that, where you're like, well, there's people at the HQ and who cares about those guys? They're off in la la land. You know, I'm out here on the ground. I'm making things happen. You know, like because of COVID in particular, Mark Porter McGee, our CEO, and myself, we thought it might be a good time to kind of take like a, you know, a position, like a mindset on how to approach the world, because we have some, you know, time and space to, and because we thought it might help our state campaigns make different decisions, given how fast the facts on the ground, you know, are changing in the last 6 months. And so the fund everything, measure everything stuff, that's new for us. You know, we normally don't like take positions in DC unless this is individuals writing op-eds and that kind of stuff. So we're gonna try it out and see what happens.
Well, that's a nice transition, because I did want to talk about this new report. You're the lead author. That is titled Fund Everything, and sort of an attempt to sort of deal with the current national crisis. So talk a little bit more about what motivated you guys to do that, what you're hoping to accomplish with that piece. And frankly, it did open my eyes, because there's some things in there that I was surprised about, from my perspective, how progressive they are. Really beginning to give power to families, give families more control over their education dollars, which is really the battle right now, right? I mean, the money is pretty much controlled by the bureaucracy. People are disempowered, and there's this power struggle. Like, are people going to have control over their kids' education and their kids' education dollars? And that's the battle we're having all over the place. And you guys started to take a position on that I perceive as progressive, that is pro-parental empowerment. So talk a little bit about why you guys wrote the report, what you're trying to accomplish with that report, why you think now's the right time to begin to move in this direction.
So I'm glad to hear you say that. And again, and thanks for reading it. I thank you for Mark as well. So in April, I think is what it was, you know, I was feeling really down, because like, you know, I'm a creature of the press and kind of a policy. So I'm like watching this narrative that was emerging at the time that was basically like, distance learning is horrible. We really need to get kids back in school. You know, all these inequities that we were okay with before, now suddenly they are unconscionable. We really need to move on these things. And for me, I was just like, look, we're in the middle of a public health crisis. This is new for everybody. This kind of thing has never happened. The facts are changing all the time. And so I wrote this piece where I was like, you know, kind of like three things. One, we need to get good at remote. You know, like Florida Virtual is doing this for people right now. So like Florida's had a ton of experience with course choice and all these other things. So I'm sort of arguing for some flavor of Florida. But I'm like, as long as we don't know what's going to happen in the fall, we need to get good at remote. My second thing was that anybody who thinks the fall is going to be some stable, orderly thing, which was basically like the myth that was being held up there as a way to like sort of tamp down on parental attitudes that were emerging, you know, because of the lockdowns. I was like, you're living in a fantasy world. I'm like, that ain't real. This is not real, you know? And then the third thing was that you started to see sort of, unfortunately, some of the worst and most sort of opportunistic behavior possible from people that we normally fight with. So, you know, there was like a detente for a while where it seemed like, hey, we're going to, you know, teachers unions and advocates and districts and whatever, we're all going to get along because like, this is horrible, right? Like people are dying and kids aren't learning and this is really bad and we need to be on the same page. But then it was like looking at the United Teachers Los Angeles contract, which like legit set basically drove down the amount of time a teacher was going to be there and drove up the price. I mean, it was like, to me, I was like, this is all a job protection. This is crazy. Like we need everybody to be like all in on this, you know? And so that was kind of the posture we were adopting internally. We were like, there are these bad things that are happening right now. This bad behavior that's happening. The fall isn't going to be easy and we need to help parents. Right. So those were like the starting things. The second thing was that the New York Times wrote an editorial when the first sort of government stimulus money, CARES money was being discussed. And it basically said, it didn't basically say, it said, send every American $2,000. And I was like, whoa, you know, with no command other than that you spend it. And I was kind of like, something's going on here. And then with CARES, et cetera, it seemed like the highest policy lever available at the federal level was just to send people money. And I remember being on a call where somebody was talking about the pandemic EBT, which was like, we're just going to give money to families so they can go buy food because school is closed. And I was like, that's tongue in cheek, revolutionary. How about we just give people money and they can go solve their own problems? And so if you took the battle lines or the key problems that were being lined up, and then you sort of wove in the fact that everybody's for universal basic something at some point, right? The idea of direct transfers was becoming more palatable. How could we use those things to solve a bevy of education problems that we thought were on the horizon, you know, whatever, right? Worst case scenario. And so out of that sort of comes like fund everything and then measure everything. And I should say like a couple quick things on these. So fund everything is not a smash and grab. It is a philosophy. We decided, it actually wasn't my decision, but Mark was kind of like, as long as the federal government is going to send money to states, we should position our response around this around that. Because otherwise you're going to get into the same like zero sum local dog eat dog fight over money that we're always fighting over, right? Which is a traditional thing. And so, you know, federal government's gonna print money, like, great, let them print money, you know? But the more important thing was that, like, parents and kids every day are trying to solve problems that are either emergent, like they've never had to deal with them before, or they are created because, like, a local school district bureaucracy has decided it doesn't wanna play ball, right? For good reasons or bad reasons. And so what would you do if you were that parent and you needed to solve that problem? And obviously at the root of this thing, because like the ways you pay for it are almost incidental, the fundamental precondition has got to be a right to choose. And then the thing that lays on top of that is an ability to circumvent boundaries of all kind that will stop you from choosing the thing that's right for you. So you can be on team reopen or not on team reopen, but like some kids need an in-person option. And we were like, if your local school does not do that and an arbitrary border stops you from getting to another school that will do that, like eliminate the border, pay for the transfer, you know? If your local district virtual option is horrible and a charter school network or an independent network has a much better one, like we should fund that. You should be able to do that. And to go one step further, and I know you'll appreciate this, some schools, networks, you know, school districts, private school networks, charter schools, whatever, have gotten really good at remote. They have like a compelling offering. So if I'm going to school virtually, right? Like, which is to say, I don't go to a physical school. Why do you care where I enroll? Like, if I'm in California, I want to wake up early enough to go to a virtual option in New York City. Why shouldn't I be able to do that? You know? And then there's like lots of other flavors of that come into existence. Like, you know, sometimes you need to solve for a micro school, right? It's me and five people. Like, we need an in-person thing. Like, We like, let us hire a teacher. You know, like, what does that mean for the teacher market, which is actually like sort of an, I mean, you're an expert on this, right? Like, I think this is one of the most interesting times to talk about how to pay and reward teachers in my, like in my public policy lifetime, because you could argue, and I'm going to sound like a little, like I'm trying to be a jerk, but I'm not, like in the district context, you get paid without regard for the result.
Right.
Right. In the private context, you only get paid for the result. So if you're an SAT tutor or something like that, it's like, I want to know, like, show me the test score. And I was kind of like, what happens if you flood this sort of newly emergent private place where the results matter with a lot of capable people? Like, maybe they find out they like it. Maybe they're like, yeah, I'll take 10 kids and do a bespoke sort of curriculum for them and do it on my time in a way that works with you and our values, comport. And when you're happy, you pay me three times as much as you would have paid me in the other context. You know, I think that's a, like a wonderful, and we should fund that, right? Like fund everything, like pay for that, you know, catalyze that. So that was that, that's kind of the fund everything thing. The other part of it is just, you know, we just call it like a measure everything, because like, we're just in this really interesting space right now where lots of cool stuff is going on, right? And I want to say this again because it's important. Like, COVID is serious. Lots of people, you know, it's had a serious effect. Lots of people have been hurt. Lots of people have died. Like, this is this. I don't want to be grim about it at all. That's not what I'm saying, right? However, there are some very interesting things that are happening in the world right now, and we need to know whether or not those things work, so that people can do more of them if need be. And so, you know, we were like, diagnostic assessment at the front of the year. That was something we heard from our parents. They're like, I want to know where my kid is.
Right.
We think it's important to keep the state summative assessment ritual in place, even if it's without stakes at this point, because the data matters, you know, even if it's noisy. We think that because learning is happening everywhere, we should find a way to reward it in the school context. So like, if you can learn it and an app can prove it, you should get credit for it. We think that really matters. Some of these tools and platforms, like everybody talks about Zurn, you know, in the spring when people were trying to codify learning loss, the only reason why they had that data was because there was a private, you know, platform out there that had collected it all. And there were these amazing insights that were derived from that, like, you know, promote that. Right. And whatever the agreements need to be around that. And then Mark, because Mark is actually like a social scientist, he's like, be deliberate about running, you know, the gold standard studies on things. Right. Like, fund the studies. Like, don't make research an afterthought, you know, like build design into trying to find out what's going on right now. So so that's kind of our story across, like, help parents get where they got to be and pay for it. Watch what happens and learn from it. And then hopefully we can, you know, we have a more dynamic, interesting system to build upon because of it when, you know, or if anything ever returns to something that looks like normal.